This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Afternoon and welcome to Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I'm Brendan Bale and David Hunt is with me.
Hello.
And a big thank you to Richard.
Richard filling in.
Yes. How amazing is that? Do you know what, David? I used to do Thursdays.
Yes.
And Richard used to be my support.
Oh.
And we always used to get chatting about film as much as I could anyway.
He's a huge film buff.
He is.
But he's also got the most amazing music knowledge.
And the
songs that he chose today were wonderful, and the mix of it was really good as well. So,
well, I'm really sad about that. I was sweating it out at the gym, so I didn't get to hear.
You
should have been tuned into Joy.
You should have.
On the Joy app, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been doing that, but I was too focused on my trainer. But that's another story. Now, speaking of film, though, speaking of Dick and film, I've got so many this week, and because I'm not going to be here next week, I'm going to maybe slip in some other ones later in the show as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to start with Woody Allen's new one called Cafe Society.
Now, I've always been a huge Woody Allen fan, backed away a fair bit over the last few years because they are a little bit same-ish, but just the look of this one, my God.
Yes.
I love the look. It's stunning.
Yeah, and after the Coen brothers' most recent film, this one's kind of in the same vein, the old Hollywood glamour.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting story, this one, about relationships. And I guess when you meet people at certain points in your life and, you know, you probably should be together, but it's just bad timing. So you've got the character of, or Jesse Eisenberg's character. He's a little bit of the sort of surrogate Woody Allen. You know, he always has a version of himself in his films. And so he is kind of the Woody Allen character this time, but probably not quite as neurotic as usual in these types of films from Woody Allen. And then he is acting opposite predominantly Christian Stewart, but you've also got people like Steve Carell in there, Blake Lively, Parker Posey, one of my favourites. And they all sort of come together, and it's quite an ensemble piece. And you've got these wonderful eccentric characters all sort of colliding with each other in Hollywood.
Yep, and it's set in the 30s.
Yes,
very glamorous, very beautiful.
New York 30s, yeah.
Oh, it's I've seen trailers for it, and the look of it's just stunning.
Well, it is, and I like the fact that it's sort of I don't know about the ratio, but sort of half and half with Hollywood and New York and the differences of what the 1930s sort of looked like in those eras.
Yeah, well, you see, because New York, of course, was still very much all about theatre, and L.A. was all about the new buck being filmed.
Yeah, and also that, you know, New York was the serious town and Hollywood was the frivolous town, and that's kind of uncovered quite well in this as well, because he's from a Jewish family, and they, you know, they want him to get a steady job in New York, and he wants to go out and live with his, I think it's his uncle.
The Wild West.
In the Wild West with Steve Carell. So, and he plays a really funny character as well, who's a little bit naughty.
That's what he does.
Yes, exactly. But a little bit more straight than usual, but still a lot of funny lines in there. So I've got to give this one 3.5. It's not a classic, but it's really easy to watch. It's really that light entertainment when Woody Allen sort of hits his mark. This is one of his better efforts in the last decade.
Yeah,
for sure.
And it's one, just because of the look of it, I might even go and see it.
Yes, and the soundtrack is beautiful as well, so you can't go wrong with that.
It's always good with him, the music.
Definitely. Yep. Now, another one, a little bit more disappointing, this one. I saw this a couple of weeks, and it's sort of finally out this week in limited release in Melbourne. Boys in the Trees. It's a new Australian film from Nicholas Verso, produced by John Molloy and written by Nicholas as well. And it's kind of, I don't know if you've seen the movie Donnie Darko.
Yep.
but it's kind of that look to the film, but it's set in the 90s, which is strange. So obviously Donnie Darko was the 80s, this is the 90s, but kind of that counterculture sort of look at what the suburbs look like. But it's set in Australia, it's an Australian film, but it's very American, if that makes any sense. It's, it's very...
Oh, how sad is that?
A little bit. I was a little bit let down by that, and there's some sort of time issues in terms of, like, things that shouldn't be in there from the 90s, and I thought, oh, it just sort of takes you a little bit away from it. But it looks absolutely beautiful. Could not fault it for its cinematography and set design and all of that, all
and
the technical
actually, that's
features.
Where we excel, isn't it?
I think so.
In
think
set
so.
Design, in photography, all those areas.
Yep.
That Hollywood's full of Australians doing that
exactly
stuff.
Exactly right, exactly right. I actually got to speak with the star, Toby Wallace, probably a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, actually, for his film Galore, and he was a great young actor then. And this one doesn't really play to his strengths. I think he is a really good actor, but I think the script let him down a little bit.
Right.
And there's some lines in there that just didn't quite mesh with me. But all of the actors themselves were really into it, you know, in for these roles that they were given. But I just felt like there should have been a few more revisions in the script. And it's a film that's pushing 2 hours, and it didn't need to be. I could see it sort of being told in sort of 90 to 100 minutes very easily, and I think it would have had a bit more punch because and I'm not going into the details too much of the actual storyline because it's probably best to go in blind, but it is kind of almost a Halloween film, so it is perfect timing for it coming out here, and there are some advantages to it, or there's some good things to it, but it did let me down, unfortunately. It's not the next Australian classic, unfortunately.
Okay. How many stars?
2 out of 5.
Okay.
Yep. And,
from the minute you started talking, I was thinking about that.
That too. Now another one that, so I won't spend too much time on this next one, The Neon Demon, because I did cover that for MIFF, but now it is out, in limited release, in Melbourne as well. So this is the new one, or the most recent one, from Nicholas Winding Refn. And you've got Elle Fanning, Jenna Malone, who is a standout in it. You've got Aussie Abby Lee and the wonderful Christina Hendricks, who has a small but memorable role. You'd probably remember her from Mad Men, the secretary.
Oh, yes.
The beautiful lady, but very, very talented as well. I understand why she didn't have a bigger part in this one, because the storyline didn't really call for it, but it would have been nice to see her in a few more scenes and a little bit more cutthroat as well, because I'm sure she plays a model executive, so looking after models and representing them, and yeah, I can imagine that world. It does delve into that of how horrible and caustic that environment can be, but I think it could have taken further. But The Neon Demon, I think I gave it 4.5 stars. I'm still going to stick with that from MIFF. It's a new classic for me. I really, really enjoyed it. Soundtrack is phenomenal. The cinematography is stunning. The use of colour is mind-blowing. Kind of takes me back to Suspiria from Dario Argento in terms of the beautiful use of colour. I can't really fault this one too much, except for this some questionable misogyny tendencies in there, and I would have to watch it once again to kind of work out where he's coming from, just to put my mind at rest in terms of what his view of, I guess, feminism and his stance on women is, the director I'm talking about,
yep.
The writer and director. So
okay.
we'll see with that one. But for now, 4.5 stars, and really one that really will stick with you if you go see it, whether you love it or hate it. Now, David.
Yes.
We had a beautiful time last night. What did we get up to?
Well, we did, but just before we start on that, I just want to talk about one other thing I saw this week. I went to the NGV for the very interesting one for the NGV, because they keep on pushing the boundaries, which I love about them. A couple of years ago, they brought in the legendary Jean-Paul Gaultier, and it was a blockbuster for them. This time round, they're in fashion, that is.
Yeah.
Because textile is one of their big parts as well, because it is, that's what it's all about, the NGV. And this time, and they've used the same guy, Canadian guy, to actually curate this one as well.
Right.
And it's Victor and Rolf from Amsterdam, and their creations are art pieces. You know, they really are. And the way they've displayed it, and they were here as well for it. And the exhibition is excellent. It's really well done, as everything is in the NGV. It's just amazing. This isn't wearable art, wearable fashion. This is extraordinary fashion.
Although I wouldn't mind wearing that, the dress with the holes in it.
Oh, incredible.
And I think that'd look amazing.
And they even make miniature dolls, which are handmade by a Belgian woman. And they make the clothes identical for these dolls as well. So they're scattered through the exhibition, and some of the ones that are actually frames, and they're framed in it. Or ones where there's actually scaffolding on the dresses with sound coming out of it and lights on it so that it's its own personal runway.
Amazing.
Just extraordinary stuff that they really push the boundaries, and it's more about art than it is about a fashion with them.
And I think that's the dialogue going forward. I think within the fashion industry there was always talk about it being art, but I think from the art perspective of looking at fashion as art,
yep.
I think that is, you know, it's definitely in motion, the change in dialogue around that, because, you know, things that NGV are doing, it really makes you think about, it is artistry. It's pure artistry.
Yep. And it's not so much on a, because they can't sell this stuff.
Right.
And it's, like donated to galleries, which they've donated one of the dresses to the NGV as well for the permanent collection. It's really good stuff. So go and see it. It's Victor and Rolf. It's on until, I think, January, February. It's all over summer. So see that. But what happened last night?
Well, we got our kink on, David.
We got our kinky boots on.
We got the boot. What an amazing night it was.
Now, last Sunday we had the producer on, and who was a delightful man, and I was just blown away last night.
And expectations were high. I don't know about you,
I didn't really have high expectations. I was expecting a good show.
Yep.
Can't believe how much money they spent on the marketing. you can't move around this city without... No. But do you know what? The really interesting thing, it just goes to show you with marketing... I was saying, you know, people vaguely ask you what you're doing on the weekend, and I was saying I was going to Kiki Boots. The amount of people that didn't even know anything about it, I find it astounding. But if you don't come into the city, you don't see all of that. So it's really interesting. But anyway, the show, tell us your thoughts.
Well, I just thought I was just blown away by it. But what I loved overall the most is that it was allowed to be soft and hard at the same time, in terms of the songwriting and the performing as well. I thought the ensemble really worked together perfectly. Mm-hmm. And you've got someone, or the character of Lola, who obviously is a standout.
Oh, my God.
And is set up to
be
that.
Well, do you know what? It's a standout, yes. But I reckon the straight guy as well. What was his name? Charles? Was it Charles?
Charlie?
Yeah. Which is Toby Francis. He really pulled it off. Like the argument that he has with Lola and with a couple of other people, astounded me. It really did. So, really thought that, but Lola was the standout.
Yeah, but I don't think, she was the standout that sort of detracted from it actually just, heightened everyone else in the cast.
Yep.
Which, but what I was sort of saying before is like they took the time, and obviously it was Cyndi Lauper all the producers and the original, I've forgotten his name now, Harvey Feistein, the writer of the book. You know, they took the time. They didn't take the easy way out. You know, it wasn't a stock standard, you know, happy, happy, happy kind of production. It was, you know, it had shades.
And it had a real message for our community, which is because it's all about drag.
And
performance.
It is about drag, but it's also about acceptance and, you know, being who you are. And I know that probably sounds a little bit corny, but it's done in such a non-corny way.
Yep.
And that the argument that you talk about was devastating to watch. And it was like a high drama kind of show.
It was a screaming match.
That part, yeah.
Yeah, screaming match. But at all, and you're like the fluffiest end you could ever imagine, which, because it was a bit gritty, because it's all set in a shoe factory, which isn't doing well. A lot of people would have already seen the film, so we're not giving anything away. Mm. And it follows the film, which is not a musical, fairly closely. But look, one of the standout tracks was, and it's when the two of them got together, and it's called Not My Father's Son, which Lola had the main vocals in it. where a lot of the other songs are high energy,
yep.
And sung with Lola and the Angels. This track, I think, is really worthwhile having a listen to. The one thing about the music from musicals these days, we don't know them until we go and see them now. Like years ago, they used to be played on commercial radio stations. Now you never hear them. There are so many good songs off of this that they could. There's Cyndi Lauper. She wrote them, especially for this, but they're unbelievably good. So let's have a listen to, this is one of the very meaningful, this, where they pour their hearts out about, you know, they're not the sons their fathers wanted them to be, both of them in very different ways. And it's called Not My Father's Son from Kinky Boots. You're on Joy 94.9.
That I could just be me. I'm not my father's son. I'm not.
Joy 94.9.
Tuning into Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9. Now, we had a track from Kinky Boots.
We did.
What a beautiful track that is.
Yep, lovely
so
track.
So if you're thinking everything's going to be glitz and glam and all craziness, yes, there's that. But there's also some softer moments as well.
Yeah, although that's the only real soft song, isn't it?
Well, there's a little bit more acoustic and a bit more fun.
Love the sort of girl that gets off the factory floor that then ends up in the office. Her song about the boss is so cute. She was good.
I was laughing at every little moment everything of that. Now, we've got a message in.
Oh, have we?
From Warren and Kerry.
Oh my God. I love these guys.
All the way from Mackay.
Yes, and I'm still pissed off with Warren. we did a walking tour of Melbourne one day, and there was somebody had a garage sale, you know, one of the shops.
Right.
And he got these great pair of shoes. He got there just before me, and they were perfect, you bastard, Warren.
I'm sure he's wearing them right now at home, kicking his feet up. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Enjoying a show from a lovely day here in Mackay. Say hi to Sue, please, David. Lots of love and hugs from Warren Kerry.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Yes. Thanks for your lovely message. I'm sure David will pass on the message to Sue. No, probably not. She's definitely listening, though. Now, let's get into our first interview, David.
Okay.
We've another friend of the show.
Yes.
We've got Melinda Martin from Linda New Art. Now, you have been here before, so people should know what you do and how you got there as well. But for those who may have missed it last time, tell us a little bit about your history in terms of, where you started in, maybe in the industry even.
Ooh. I spent way too long at university, way, way too long, and misspent youth. What can I say? I ended up working for a artist called John Young, so who's a successful artist who shows here in Melbourne. And then from there, I went on to work in the Monash Gallery of Art in Willis Hill, managing their photography collection. And from there, I went to work what is now known as Creative Partnerships Australia, where I managed a program of services across the country for artists and in philanthropy and all sorts of things. And then I became the director at Linden nearly 6 years ago.
Where is it for those that don't know?
So Linden is we're based in a Victorian home in Ackland Street in St Kilda.
A beautiful home and beautiful surroundings there as well.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Just, although the grounds are lovely as well. Now, what does Linden do?
Well, we're a contemporary art gallery that specialises predominantly in showing the works of mid-career artists. So we show artists who are kind of 10 to 15 years out of art school, and we show their work. So our last exhibition was Alec Tapoti, who's a contemporary Indigenous artist from Batu Island, mm-hmm. right up past, closer to Papua New Guinea than it is to anywhere in Australia.
Wow.
And our current exhibition is the Linden Postcard Show.
Which is an annual event?
It has been going for 27 years,
gosh.
I believe.
Wow.
I think if we ever dared to not put it on, we'd be run out of town.
Right. And what does this postcard exhibition do?
And
it's competition as well.
Yeah. So essentially it's an open entry competition. Any artist from across the country, whether they're a child, a hobby artist, a professional artist, can enter. The only rule is that the artwork must be 8 by 10 inches.
A postcard.
A postcard size,
yep.
Essentially.
And the wonderful thing is that we actually interviewed the person that won it last year.
Indeed.
And he had entered many times before, mm-hmm. and that's what happens.
Yep.
People enter year after year.
I think one of the artists that I spoke to recently has entered it every year since 2000.
Gosh.
So that's going on a little while. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, I think our youngest entrant this year is 8.
Oh, lovely.
But I'm not sure how much the oldest one is, but we'll come to that at some point.
Now, you can actually buy these postcards too, can't you?
You can indeed. So I think one of the least expensive works is about $50, and then it goes up to about $6,000 as the most expensive work. And that depends on the artist's experience and how much they choose to sell the work for.
And it was launched on Friday night, and I believe it was a huge success.
We thought Friday night, pouring with rain, everyone's going to stay at home. No, everyone decided to come out to the postcard show, and we had, I think, over 500 people.
Awesome.
That's fabulous.
Great. So I haven't seen it this year yet, but last year the way you displayed it was excellent. You did it in massive groups, which you have to because you've got so many. But it's done very stylish, isn't it? Are you similar this year?
We endeavour to be as stylish as we possibly can. This year we have themed it in groups. So we've got people's faces all together.
Okay.
We've got landscapes together, different kind of groups depending on the work that's available.
Right. And what pattern do you see within this art? Is it a reflection of what's going on in the art world, or can it be just so eclectic you can't actually pick anything up?
It is absolutely so eclectic that you can't pick anything up. And that's one of the great things about the show. It's so vibrant and so colourful that you can just wander around and discover something, a little gem, every time you walk into the show.
Yeah. And in a lot of cases, it's a nice way for people to have their first step maybe into buying a piece of art.
Absolutely. We have people who will come and buy their first ever original artwork, and then we'll have people who come every year to buy something. So
Wow. They
have a collection now that's been going for nearly 30 years of an artwork that they've bought every year.
Do you get to sort of talk to the buyers about, you know, I guess what they're looking for each year, the habitual ones?
It's quite interesting. Sometimes I feel like I become a relationship counsellor during this show, where sometimes you'll walk into one of the galleries and you'll hear someone saying, "That is not coming into our house."
Oh, gosh, then
you'll hear someone else going, "But this is the one I love. I cannot believe you don't like this." So we just kind of try and say, well, you know, you could have a different room for each work, which is important. So it's one of those great things that allows people to have really healthy conversations about it.
Cool. And in terms of the new artists getting involved as well, you know, what's the feedback that you get in terms of how they found out about it, or, you know, why they wanted to get involved in the first place?
It's a bit of a mix, and it depends on their background. Mm. So we have lots of artists who might be still at university or might be just have left university who will actually be studying, and they want to show their work in front of the judges. So we have a panel of arts industry experts. Mm. So for them, it's important to have their work seen by those people. For other people, it's about supporting the community experience in actually entering, because they love being part of the show, and that's part of the kind of celebration of creativity as well.
We've got to stop you right here because there's so much more to talk about. We're talking to Melinda Martin, Linden New Art down there in St Kilda. And, of course, we're talking about the postcard exhibition, postcard show it's called. We'll be back in a moment.
Joy.
You're tuned in to Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine. Brendan Bale with you and David John Hunt sitting opposite
me.
Yes,
get my name right.
And the lovely Neil, he is in charge.
Paneling.
And taking control, trying to keep us under control. Now, if you do want to get in touch with us, 0427 Joy 949, that's our SMS, or you can email onair@joy.org.au, and make sure you catch up on any of our podcasts at joy.org.au as well. But we've got Melinda Martin from Linden New Art, and we haven't let her go yet. We've got so much more to talk about. But my day job, I do have a job, which is good. I got sent a press release about this current exhibition, and one of the artists' work that really just jumped out at me, probably because it was featuring such an iconic character, but Kelly Sullivan and her work, Boy with the Pearl Earring, which is a takeoff of Girl with the Pearl Earring, the classic. Such a striking piece. You know, do you sort of count your blessings when you receive these beautiful works that come in and you're just floored by them? Because I was.
It's really hard, because sometimes there's over 870 works on display, so we kind of have this like little moment where you're just like, wow, that's incredible. This might be a really tiny, very detailed painting, or it might be a beautiful photograph. It's just the kind of creativity that's out there is just stunning. But I think Kelly is one of those really interesting artists. Kelly put the image up on her Facebook mm-hmm. page, and I think we then had to sort of someone ring us and say, I really want that work. And we're like, okay, we can do it on the opening night. All right. So someone from Canberra bought the work because Kelly had promoted it herself.
Now, how did she know about the prize?
So Kelly is an artist who is studying at ANU in Canberra, and right. we regularly send out all the call for entries each year to all the universities. We send posters and flyers. We also work with Avant-Card, and they do promotional card for us. And
Australia-wide.
Fantastic. So we've got artists from every state of Australia.
Right. And that's the really lovely side of it, isn't it, is that you're getting the people going through art school and the professional people and like the 8-year-old girl, as you said. It makes it very community-driven, which is, of course, that's what you're all about anyway, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it's really important, I think, to have opportunities for people. You know, very few people get a chance to hang an artwork on a gallery wall, and to give people that opportunity to have that excitement and that buzz about it is really exciting.
Yeah.
But you're talking about Kelly with her Facebook and with my work, we put it on our official Instagram mm-hmm. account, and obviously linked to her page and everything, and she was very happy about that because more people got to see it. So, how are these social channels changing the way that artists are sort of sharing their work then?
I think it's really changing, and I think it's an exciting thing because things like Instagram are such a visual medium,
right.
people can suddenly be promoting their work to a world community, and it depends on the themes within the work. So if you put something like Prince or Girl with a Pearl Earring as your hashtag, you're going to get all these people
yes.
who follow Prince who may never have thought of buying an artwork in their life, but actually are so drawn to the image that they simply want to have it. So I think that's something really great about that social media.
And have you seen other circumstances of that sort of over the years, especially probably recently?
It's really starting to happen. I still think it's really, for me, it is odd because I grew up in a world pre-computer to buy an artwork that you haven't seen in the flesh, but lots of people still do it. Like lots of people are currently, you'll send an image, see an image, and then they'll fall in love with the image and buy work without actually having never seen it in the flesh.
Excellent. So, you've got to get down to Alinden, A New Art on Ackland Street in St Kilda. It's an amazing place. It's a postcard show. It runs till when?
The 29th of January next
year. Right, okay. Now, something major's happening with you guys next year. What?
We are having, literally the roof is coming off our building. Her head's been chopped off.
Why? You just need to replace it?
She's a bit leaky.
Right.
Because
it is a beautiful, as you mentioned, it's a beautiful, what do you call it?
Victorian mansion, really.
Yeah.
And it's one of those, it was built in the 1850s, so, she's been around for a while and she just needs a little bit of a facelift, essentially.
A bit of a spruce up.
And because she's owned by the council.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and which support you you guys heavily. So it's lovely that they're keeping this very beautiful building intact.
Indeed, and it's a really significant investment by the City of Port Phillip to support the building. It's over a $2 million investment, and it means we get a new entrance, which meets new disability requirements, and we get a little bit of extra exhibition space, which is exciting for us. And so while we have to be out of the building for 6 months, we're going to pop up. We're not going to, close down or go anywhere else. We're going to pop up into Domain House, which is, for many people who live in Melbourne, the old Acca, the original Acca, just near the Botanical Gardens, tucked in behind the shrine. So we'll be there doing some other great shows while we're temporarily relocated out of the building.
And when's that happening?
We'll be leaving in about mid-March, and then we come back, hopefully, if all things go beautifully.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck. Touch some kind of wood. We'll be back in the building for the postcard show in 2017 in late October.
Okay. And what's coming up after the postcard?
So the next show that we have is a show by Penny Byrne, who is a ceramic artist, and she is trained as a ceramic conservator, and then she's had this whole artistic process as well. One of the great things is Penny first entered the postcard show And that's when her artistic career began.
Wow.
She was then picked up by a commercial gallery and has since then had a great success. So Penny will have a solo show with us, and then we're also doing a show called Changing Places, which is a group show. We've just invited artists to send in proposals. And then they'll be our, you know, last shows in Linden for a little bit, and then we're, you know, off to our new adventure.
So even the office and everything has to move?
Absolutely.
Our
offices are upstairs, so,
so
we're literally all out of the building for a little while, but we're looking forward to a new adventure and meeting people who haven't been to Linden before, which would be great.
Excellent. Thank you so much for coming in. It's always a pleasure to have you come in, and always a pleasure to find out what's going on at that. You know, like, it really is one of the premier galleries now, and so thank you for having and thank you for saving that beautiful building.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're on Joy 94.9 and it's Sunday Arts Magazine. Big thank you to Melinda Martin.
Joy 94.9 in Melbourne, joy.org.au for the world.
We have the moon in the sky above.
Perfect Sunday track on Sunday Arts.
I was just saying off air, you know, what a voice. And you can recognise it straight away. Of course, we're talking about Sade.
Yes, and that was The Moon and the Sky.
Yeah. An album that she released, it didn't do all that well, unfortunately. A lot of people have moved on from artists like her, but I love this album. It's one that every track is, and it's puts you in a beautiful mood. She really does.
Definitely. And we need all the help we can get on a Sunday, don't we, David?
Well, especially considering that I had a fairly late night last night. And somebody that I know left me stranded. I was looking for you.
Do you know what? It was so busy, I thought you'd done a run on me. So
yeah. But the funny thing is, I was literally behind you, but I had my back, and we bumped into mutual friends.
Yes.
And I said, oh, Brendan's here. And then I was suddenly turned around and he was gone.
Yeah. That's what happens when you're networking. It's a pitfall. Now, David, our next interview, we're going to keep with the art theme,
yes,
which is perfect.
And something very, very big in Australia.
Huge, yep. Huge. We've got Heidi Yardley coming in. Talking about the Archibald Prize and specifically the exhibition in Ballarat.
Yep.
That is till November 27th. So thank you for coming in firstly.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations for being one of the finalists.
Thank you.
How does that feel?
It's always really great when you get the email because you know how many people have entered and just how hard it is to, once they whittle it down to the final amount. I think there's usually 900 or 1,000 entries. So
gosh, and how many
30
end up
or
in the
40,
30 or 40.
Or may have gone up to 50. I'm not sure this year. I haven't counted, but there's definitely less than 50.
Yeah. Now, we'll come back to talk about who you painted and the exhibition. But we always like to start, Brendan. What do we like to ask?
We always like to ask where you sort of got the inspiration to become an artist. Was it something that was just completely ingrained in you from a young age?
Yeah, definitely. When I was very young, I was always drawing, and then it was my favourite subject. And then I just decided by the time I was at high school that I would do as much as I could. So I did VCE, and I did art and studio art. So two out of my however many subjects you have in the final year is five or something. And I was really just locked in my bedroom a lot of the time, just drawing on the floor, my favourite place to be. And I knew that that's what I wanted to pursue. So,
but that's a tough lifestyle, because until you get down the track a little bit that you are a finalist of the Archibald Prize, is that financially it's very hard.
And you don't think, before you go to art school, you don't consider those things. Everyone's asking you, where are you going to study or what are you going to do? So that's your first thought. And then as a student, most people have part-time jobs or support themselves or live at home for a while. And then I think reality bites when you get out of uni. And then the first thing I did was rent a studio space in Collingwood.
Oh, okay.
And there was hardly anyone around. I just worked in isolation, and I just had the tenacity, I suppose, I didn't need to have someone needing to see my work for me to have the motivation to make it. But I did book in a solo show that was self-organised pretty soon after graduating, because I just felt that was the next step. So I've been exhibiting since I was really young.
And have you made a living out of it?
I do. I'm probably my eighth year of being a full-time artist, but it took me a very long time. I did everything from life modelling to cleaning jobs to market research, you name it. I mean, that was, I did also do teaching, but I found that too consuming. So it just was a matter of, I mean, I've always had a lot of interest and a lot of clients and followers and collectors, and so I've just brought them along with me, and my galleries have helped support that. So, yeah.
So why do you think you've been so self-directed? Is it, I guess, just a confidence in your own work, or that you just work better
It's hard to say. Yeah, I'm really good at working in solitude, and I don't have any problem being alone and focusing on my ideas. But it's been a long journey, so I can't say it was straightforward. It was just finding your way in the industry as well, learning about how the whole thing works.
Did you have any sort of people that you looked up to or were influenced by during that journey?
Yeah, always artists that I would be my favourites, and that I would follow their work, and definitely lots of different people.
And so who were some of those then?
Oh, it's interesting. I just went to Louise Hearman's show at the MCA, and she was always one of my favourite painters, and she still is. She's just got a real skill with oil paint. A lot of international artists. I probably couldn't name them all, but that I've just followed. And
so portraiture, is it an area that you like to specialise in?
I love figurative work. I've always loved painting and drawing the figure, but I do like the idea of the figures that I create being anonymous, so they're more like archetypes and they're not named people. But that does confuse people, because if they've got a face, they will say, who is that?
Right. And
I work a lot from vintage images from old magazines and things like that, so found images, and they are literally, they're anonymous to me, so they're really trying to make a statement about what it is to be human rather than being one individual with a name. So I do a bit of, I do portraiture, probably one portrait a year.
Right, and, well, this is your third time in the Archibald Prize. So obviously you're getting into the swing of it. And what was it like when you were actually having to paint somebody that is a celebrity per se?
Yeah, I never really liked the idea of the celebrity aspect, but I mean, the first work I entered was a self-portrait. And that was, I was very, very surprised to get in. I think that was 2013. People liked it a lot more than I did.
well, it was self, so, yourself, of course you wouldn't.
Yeah, no. And it was just, yeah, it somehow resonated with people. So that was really great. And then the next time I decided to, I really like to support female artists. So I painted Julia DeVille, and she was great. And this current work is of an artist called Nell, who's Sydney-based multidisciplinary artist.
And how many times did you meet with her? And do you take photographs to remember?
Yeah, she came to Melbourne. She came to my house, the studio where I work, and we just spent the day together, and we did photographs, and I do sketches and things like that. But the photographic medium's always, you know, I always have that as a resource.
Yeah.
So most people do, actually.
Yeah. And what about the conversation that you're having with when you're doing somebody's portrait? To get to know the person, so you get that inner feeling of them. Is that important to you?
It's important to know about them, and in my case, I usually choose someone I actually admire, or there's something different about their practice to mine specifically that I find interesting. Both Julia and Nell are really very focused and really, really driven, and there's some things about them that I can relate to, but they're very, very different people to me. And so, yes, it's just, well, it can be awkward. You've just got to have a chat when someone's posing for you. It's not fun for them necessarily because they feel under pressure. So you've got to make it easy for both of you and just keep it light and have a cup of tea rather than what's your life story, you know. Yeah. Do your research, so you should know a bit about them if you don't know them well anyway. Yeah.
We're going to get to know more about you in just a moment. We've got Heidi Yardley, artist, in the studio. You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
You're listening to
Your Voice, Your Radio Station.
A bit more of Jillian. You're listening to the gayest station in the nation.
That was funny.
On, oh, thank you, David. Joe 94.9. Oh, it had to happen sometime, David. It's only taken 2.5 years. I am Brendan Bale. David Hunt is opposite me, and we've got Neil as well. And we also haven't let Heidi Yardley go as well, artist who is showing at the Art Gallery of Ballarat. I was going to say Bendigo, but it's Ballarat. There is Bendigo as well.
Get them
mixed up. Yeah. But we sort of left the conversation talking about, your sort of process for, your work doing the Archibald Prize portraits. So I just wanted to really know in terms of, do you pick up on differences between the work you do for that as opposed to the anonymous ones you do as well?
Oh, definitely. The portraits, sounds bad, probably more contrived, only because the whole idea of portraiture is kind of contrived in itself. If you come across one that looks really natural and not too posed, you know, that's amazing. It's very hard for artists to do that. And in my case, I probably overthink it sometimes, but then working with drawings and studies and then photography, I can kind of just pull out what I think is going to be a strong composition and at worst, I might overwork it, and at best, you know, I'll get a good result, but it's quite different, as you say, to the process in my paintings that aren't traditional sort of portraits.
Yeah. Now, being part of the Archibald Prize, it's the publicly the most known exhibition in Australia, and it's a prize, and it gets the coverage it gets in the media is absolutely astounding every year. And the fact that this the exhibition now travels, and it's in Ballarat, and it's the second year, I think, isn't it, that's been in Ballarat, or maybe even longer.
I think so. It was at Mornington,
yep,
the previous one. Yeah.
So you went up for the official shortlist, which you were part of this year, of course. That's why you're part of it. What's it like when you walk into this exhibition with all these other people's works, lots of famous faces, and I find that when I've been to the Archibald Prize, a lot of people are talking about, oh, look, there's such and such. And instead of looking at the art, you know, like, you do fellow female artists, is what you paint for Archibald. What's your opinion? What's your feeling when you're in the gallery looking at it?
It's kind of overwhelming when you walk in because they do an artist lunch, which is really just standing around looking at the show and having wine and some sandwiches thrown in, and you are allowed to, you're encouraged to invite your sitter. So you will find that some of those people, some well-known people are there, and the other artists, if you've met artists before, it's great chance to catch up. If you haven't, you get to meet new ones, and that's just a really great feeling. Everyone's really excited to be there.
And they're all keen to want to chat, because why wouldn't
you? Yeah, and then you go to the pub afterwards, it doesn't end, and then it happens all over the next day.
Oh, excellent.
Because the big opening the following night. So it's really a few days of socialising and engaging with the work and lots of interviews and various things going on. Yeah.
Do you like all that side of it?
I didn't think that I would, but I've just met the most wonderful people and made really good friends, and just, you can just go and support each other and have a good time. And yeah, you know, we all are judgmental. We'll all go through and just, don't really like that one. And you know, it's just such a diverse range of artworks. So.
On the flip side though, do you sometimes like walk up to a painting and think, you know, how did you do that? Like, do you ever ask for tips in terms of technique at all?
I think all artists look at paintings and try and work out how it's done. Mm. It's easier for us, but I don't know. I haven't asked anyone for tips.
It'd be quite daunting, I would assume.
But yeah, sometimes you can stare for ages thinking, how on earth, you know, the detail in this work, or there's some very really crazy large scale pieces and you can't even imagine how they got them.
Well, I love to look at a painting and study it and work it. And being a total novice, and especially when you look at some of the classic paintings in through history, and there's always these wonderful backstories to them. I can't see this. I can't understand that. But it's what I'm enthralled by. So for an artist themselves, you must find it really interesting working out how it's done, why they did it that way, or trying to work out the technique, as you said.
And if you're familiar with an artist's practice, you might already, you know, be aware of their processes. And they do those labels on the side that are quite extensive. It explains their relationship with the sitter and the idea behind the work, and that always helps as well.
Yep.
So,
is there anyone back in history, you say that you support a lot of female artists that are around today, and that's who you've painted for Archibald. Is there, you go to the NGV and that beautiful gallery we have here with so much amazing history on the walls. Mm. Is there artists you look at and you go, wow, that's incredible?
Probably a lot of the 17th century paintings there. I don't really know all the artists' names, but they do blow your mind with the glazes and the way that they
get
skin.
And how primitive.
I'm not formally trained in a technique. I just sort of taught myself how to paint. So, yeah, I'm always in awe of really great historical painters.
Yeah, and it would have been so hard for them with light in a lot of cases, because they were only working by candlelight and not being as knowing about the world as much as what we do as well. So it would only be in one particular area that they would be following what other people would be doing, or just creating their own style of painting.
I think they had a more rigorous training regime, though. There'll be people who are, you know, the student of someone. And,
yes.
And so the techniques were really well considered, and people mixing their own paint from the pigments. And, I mean, if you go back to early portraiture, I'm sure they knew more than we do now. Because they had a reason.
Oh, do you think so?
Yeah. And contemporary art allows you to, it's great because you don't have to just have a mannerism or a technique that's completely pre-formulated, but there's something lost within losing that knowledge as well, I think, for some painters. You know.
Yeah, and a lot of the masters, they actually say that students painted some of their most famous works. They gave the guidelines.
Some of it's not known.
Yeah, it's, I find that really interesting. What's next for you? You're moving into a new studio here in the city.
Yeah. Yep. That's keeping me busy. I just had a solo show in August, so...
And how did you go?
Yeah, great. It was a drawing show, so just charcoal works on paper, and I had a great response. It was actually a really nice show to have. And, yes, I've got a couple of group shows coming up, but I'll be working on a new body of work for a show in Sydney, probably second half of next year.
Oh, okay. So you show in other cities?
Sydney and Brisbane, yeah.
Right.
Mainly, yeah.
Why?
Because I'm represented there, I guess. That's just how the people I met.
Yeah.
It's good to show interstate. But
excellent.
I like showing in Melbourne too.
Well, I'm sure you do. Your home, is it your hometown?
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
from here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. And why have you got this space in the city to paint? Do you like to have to walk away from where you live into a space that this is work, here I am?
I've done both. I have been working at home for years, and I'm quite good at that if I've got the right space, but I do have to move out of that space, so that this place came up as a really great opportunity. I look forward to working there as soon as I can. It's been a bit of an effort to just get it set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations again for being part of this amazing exhibition that happens every year. And the third time, my God, you're going to win one very soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, now, David. Make sure you do check it out. It's running until November 27 at the Art Gallery of Ballarat.
Yes, not Bendigo, Ballarat.
So get on the train, do as David did.
Yeah.
And check it out.
Oh, and it's wonderful. And you arrive at the station in Ballarat. They've got all arrows with little messages, Archibald this way, Archibald this way. And literally the whole train files up and is checking it out. It's a lovely trip. And the city. Oh, my God.
Beautiful.
Architecturally, it's amazing. So thank you, Heidi, for coming in today.
Thank you.
You're on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine.
Bringing a little joy to your life. Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine. Brendan Bale and David Hunt with you. Take you through till 5 p.m. Then we've got to hand over the reins to Robin Mossy.
Oh, no, not those two.
We do. But we've got another duo in the studio right now.
And somebody that's quite well known around the traps.
I've heard his name thrown around a little bit. We've got Luke Gallagher.
Good afternoon.
You're on Joy 94.9. How often have I heard your voice on Friday Drive?
We'll have to explain to Teresa why that's a possibility, why that happens. But yes, you do hear my voice quite a bit.
Yes, you're the voice of Friday Drive. You do all our IDs.
And often I'm overseas when I'm doing them. It's
you're
amazing.
So
I'm ever present.
Oh, God, you're so clever.
So reliable.
So thank you for doing the voiceover for Friday Drive.
But it's all about Sunday Arts Magazine.
It's
right
all
now.
About Sunday Arts Magazine right
and,
now.
And you've brought in a friend today, Teresa Borg, director, and then you're the producer of The Light in the Piazza. But we're going to get to that. We'll have plenty of time to talk about the show.
Excellent.
But for people that don't know much about you, Luke,
is there anyone in Melbourne that doesn't?
Well, do you know what? Because I've only been here 5 years. I don't know all about Luke's backstory. So I actually am really interested in how you got started in the arts, Luke.
Look, he's not even paying attention.
I am.
He's
I'm
tweeting.
Trying. No, I'm just doing. I'm trying to keep the dream alive. I've been thrilled to be a part of Joy for many, many years.
Right. Now, it's you're from Bendigo, aren't you?
Originally grew up in Bendigo, yeah. The country, and moved to Melbourne when I was 18.
And I can remember sitting next to your mother and father Dolly Diamond show, and I know all about you, and that the fact that they told me as a teenager or even a young boy that you were, you know, the arts was what you were all about, and you would be going off singing and being part of different theatre pieces and stuff. So
I was always a singer.
There.
Yeah, for a very musical family. We used to call ourselves the Von Gallagher family singers. And Teresa's much the same. She comes from a big family of musicians as well. And we grew up singing, and it was mainly around the Catholic church sort of singing stuff with mum and dad. But then I joined choirs and did amateur shows, and then I moved to Melbourne and started doing professional stuff. And then I trained in the arts. I did a drama and dance degree, which is hilarious. I look at Tess as I say that, sort of thinking, sweet Lord, don't let anyone ever see me dance. But I did all of that and then continued performing, and then was very fortunate to sort of sidestep into production.
Yeah. Now, just before we move into that, you really do have quite a spectacular voice, and which is a gift, isn't it?
Very sweet. Thank you.
It's not something that you can, you know, obviously you can train it and whatever, but I'm always bewildered that you're not a professional singer in many shapes or forms.
I guess I am a professional singer, but I don't choose to work professionally, you know, making my living as a singer these days.
Yep. So what do you do? Well, go on.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying so many other people do it beautifully, and I'm very lucky to have been given, you know, a voice that I can use in that way, but I don't. I've just found other things and other passions that I'm very lucky and very happy to be pursuing as an artist.
And a lot of it has got to do with children.
That's right. Well, Teresa and I do work and have an amazing company that Teresa created called The Entertainment Store, and then we sort of became Lifelike Touring, another company, and we do produce amazing family entertainment that now travels the world. Mm. Like, we were just in London only a couple of months ago opening Scooby-Doo Live on the West End in London.
Amazing.
Which is pretty extraordinary.
Is that a market that you think hasn't really been tapped into enough? Like, you see a hole in the gap.
Well,
the market
as well as
there.
We do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We like to think that we're leading the way in some ways.
And the Wiggles.
Well, do you know, we did work with the Wiggles many years ago for a long time, and they were very supportive, and we helped them, and they helped us, and then we just kept going. We're doing all sorts of things.
Took the ball and ran with it.
Exactly. And we're so lucky that it's been such a success, and that we do get to really travel the world. I'm off to Saudi Arabia in a few weeks.
You are?
With another show. So there's lots of stuff happening all the time.
Yeah. So, Teresa, give us your background.
I grew up singing,
and I went and did a Bachelor of Education in Music and then went to VCA and Opera Studio. Luke and I actually met during doing Schools Company for the old VSO, so we've been friends for a very long time, and he went to uni with my husband. So we're very, very old friends. And then I sang for my living in my 20s. I did Phantom and Les Mis and Cats, all of those things.
The big shows, the major shows. This one's done them all. It's extraordinary.
And then Anton and I, you know, when we got married, we wanted to be able to bring up a family and not be relying on other people to choose us. So we started the entertainment store and we brought our friends on board, and here we are now, really. We've just, you know, tried to develop our artistry in lots of directions so that we can make art and a living at the same time.
What was the biggest turning point to get that momentum going? You know, was there a turning point that you can sort of look back and say, oh, that's when everything sort of came into place?
Necessity, I would call it, Brendan. Right. Necessity. So, Anton had always managed bands at university, and we both were out of work when we got married. And he said, if you want to start this company, cold call everybody in this Yellow Pages. It was the days of the Yellow Pages. Right. And I did. And when he came home, I'd called them all and he said, right, we'll do it.
Wow. But how do you sort of, like, work with the logistics of that? You know, how did you sort of pull in everyone, as you said?
What we tried to do was do what we knew as well as we could. So we'd both been working for Gordon Frost and Cameron McIntosh, and Luke had worked with the opera and with Disney. And so we started in shopping centres, and we just tried to make it as absolutely professional as possible, because we were determined to break that sort of artistic garret ceiling where people presume that artists are incompetent. I mean, most of the artists I know are most of the intelligent people I know. Mm. I have friends who are opera singers who have doctorates in physics and doctorates of philosophy, et cetera, et cetera. So we thought, well, we can do that. And we worked out that the main thing was to make sure that we were on time and doing a good job. And it all sort of went from there. When we wrote shows, we tried to make them the best possible jobs, shows that they could be. They were for whether they were Dorothy the Dinosaur or for Peppa Pig, whatever we've done, we've tried to do it really well.
Oh, I love Peppa Pig. Now, tell us, Luke, what's the show that you're going to put on for adults, not for the kiddies?
Well, we're really lucky. I mean, probably 4 years ago now, Teresa and her partners in crime, who are the directors of our company, Anton Beres and her husband, and Troy Sussman, who was a co-director, they really wanted for us to be able to pursue contemporary musical theatre for a larger audience, not just for kids, even though we'd been doing the kids stuff pretty darn well, I think, for many years. And really, it was where we'd all come from. That was our background, was professional musical theatre. So we kind of thought, well, why aren't we doing it up on the main stage? Why aren't we doing bigger projects? And I remember they saw the first thing that we produced was Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine's wonderful musical. It's kind of like a chamber musical called Passion, which has had very few airings in this country, certainly very little, if any, professional productions. So the first thing that we did was Passion 3 years ago at Arts Centre Melbourne. And that was a huge success, and also a critical and an artistic success. Everyone kind of couldn't believe what they were seeing, I think.
Well, it was a conversation starter. I was actually lucky enough to go along, and it was beautiful.
And there was a lot really of people beautiful. Suddenly thinking, who are these guys? Where have they come from? Even though they kind of knew us, and they knew of us, and they'd maybe worked with us, but they'd not necessarily been aware that we had this yearning to sort of go a little bit deeper and a little bit further. And we did Passion in the first year, which was a huge success. And then the following year, last year, we did City of Angels, wonderful musical set in that sort of golden years of Hollywood.
Highly contrasting.
Highly contrasting. In fact, it's half black and white, half colour, so it couldn't have been more contrasting. And then this year it was decided, Teresa really loved the show, as I think everyone does, The Light in the Piazza. And that's what we're presenting. Lifelike Company is the company. We've created a third entity within our group of companies, and Lifelike Company now is producing The Light in the Piazza, and we open this Friday.
Friday. Now, why this piece?
Well, I am so fond of the lead character. Her name's Margaret Johnson, and it's not often you meet a woman of a certain age who is centre stage in a musical. And Margaret is a busy housewife and mother of the 1950s. And essentially, Margaret makes choices that make her a rebel. And she's a champion for her daughter's happiness. She has a very unconventional daughter, a champion for her daughter's happiness, and also a bit of a rebellion against her context. You know, she comes from North Carolina, which was the last state of the United States to achieve suffrage for women, and then only by default they didn't actually ratify it until 1971, which is extraordinary.
Wow.
I know, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Eugenics was practiced there until 1977, so people with any sort of impairment, it was recommended that they be sterilised.
Mm.
And Jim Crow, of course, the Jim Crow laws meant that there was segregation of the races. So this woman, Margaret Johnson, a woman of a certain age, takes her daughter Clara back to Florence, on which is where Margaret actually had her honeymoon. Clara falls in love in Italy.
As you do.
And I mean, that's one of the other great joys. Luke and I actually did go to Florence for a little bit of research. It was such hard work.
My favourite city in the world. After Melbourne, beautiful. It's my favourite city.
Oh, it's glorious, isn't it? I mean, and why not? Why not come to Florence with us for the night?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Clara falls in love with an Italian man, and it becomes apparent that Margaret's reluctant to leave her there. And that's the story of the musical, the choices Margaret makes to support her daughter.
And the look of it, from what I'm seeing, the images, is that the 50s, it was, like years ago we looked at the 50s and it was a yucky period, but it's not. It's the beautiful, the costumes, the clothes, and so the costumes you're using, from what I've seen, is spot on and quite beautiful. Oh, who's done all of that?
Kim Bishop. We're so lucky to have Kim Bishop, who's a well-known Melbourne costumier and designer, on board. And when Kim and I were speaking about it, we went back to Elizabeth Spencer's novella for the look. And Margaret has traditionally been put in two-piece sort of middle-aged looking costumes, but we've made her much more fabulous. And she's wearing costumes inspired by Givenchy and Dior.
Oh, God.
Kim is extraordinary. Tell. He's an amazing designer.
Yeah.
And he just makes magic. And there's a series of beautiful dresses, but just
and hats.
Better. And hats.
Lots of hats.
Now, for people who don't know much about it, because it's not all that well known, this piece, is it?
Well, it won 6 Tony Awards back in the day.
But not here.
No,
in Australia.
It hasn't had the professional production that it deserved, which is why we really wanted to bring it to Melbourne. And we're very proud of it. And I think once people see it, they'll go, sweet Lord, it is incredible. How have we not heard this music earlier?
And yes, and that is the whole point. So let's hear a track from it. It's the title track. Can you give us a bit of information about this particular track?
Yes. Well, young Clara tells her mother that she's in love, and she really resists and rebels against her mother for the first time.
Oh, okay. And the track is, Brendan?
Light in the Piazza on Joy 94.9.
I don't see a miracle shining from the sky. I'm no good at statues.
Joy 94.9. Thank you so much for tuning in to Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine, Brendan Bale and David Hunt with you. And we've got a lovely, lovely message in. It is from Donna Frock. How wonderful to hear the lovely Luke Gallagher. Donna Frock is listening to her trusty transistor in Eagle Hawk alongside the Countess Sibylla Deluxe, just a few kilometres away from Luke's family home. Kev and Barb must be so proud. Mwah.
Thank you, Donna. What a lovely message. It's so good to hear your name on the airwaves once more.
Yes.
Now, that beautiful piece of music we heard just a minute ago is the title track from the piece.
The Light in the Piazza.
Right. Okay. So you've just come back from Florence, as you do. I'm not happy that you went and I didn't go. To get inspiration was...
Yes,
we had an accidental couple of days between Singapore and London where we were officially working, and we said, why come home? Let's go to Florence.
Why not take an opportunity for a little side trip? It was actually probably one of the most amazing things we could have done in preparing for the show. And everyone laughs and says, oh, God, lordy, what a work trip. But we were so inspired. And Teresa has told this story to many people. You should probably tell the story about asking me to get up.
Yes, well, I said to Luke, look, we have to beat the tourists. We have to be up early. Uh-huh. And he was all for it until he realised that I meant 5:30 in the morning. But we did.
We did it. And what an amazing thing to do, because we wanted to see that light in the piazza. Mm. We wanted to see the Piazza della Signoria come to life at 5, 6 a.m. and experience that amazing world.
It's just glorious. Yeah. You know, the light comes through the buildings and it hits the windows on the other side, and everything's dappled in gold.
And that was that. I mean, if you want to know, I mean, that was actually the inspiration for the design of this show, mm-hmm. this production, because our designer had some wonderful ideas. And then when Tess and I got back from Italy, we said, well, we were blown away by the experience of visiting the Uffizi Gallery, because there's so much about the art and so much about Florence and the depiction of the mother and child. There's artwork featuring the Madonna and child all over Florence. Like, yep. It's everywhere. There are little, tiny little paintings in shop windows and, you know, etchings. There are carvings.
The street corners, all the iconography.
It's really beautiful. And that became an inspiration for our design, as did all of the art in the Uffizi. And so our designer, Tom Willis, took that on board and ran with it. And it's become the most lavish, stunning design for this. There's lots of art in the air, and it you feel like you're visiting and you're in the corridors of the Uffizi watching this show. It's quite amazing.
And do you think it's sort of about respecting the history and the majesty of those works as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes, and I feel that the history of Florence is sort of intertwined with the story of Margaret and her husband, Roy, and Clara. Oh. So the writing is just exquisite, actually. The text is bejeweled. And things like the war in their marriage sort of coincides with the war in Italy during the Second World War, things like that. It's very, very cleverly written.
Now, tell us about the cast.
They're pretty amazing.
We'll
tell you that for nothing.
Yeah. Well, Chelsea Plumley is leading as Margaret Johnson, and she's extraordinary in the role. I'm so thrilled to have her. Mm. She sings beautifully, and her acting's up there with Katharine Hepburn. She's fabulous. And she actually wanted the role so badly, she won't mind me telling you this, that she did her audition brilliantly. And we're all like, oh, wow, she's amazing. And then she said, look, can I just show you something I prepared earlier? And she actually crawled in on her hands and knees and said, please give me this role. I really have to play it. I love Margaret. So how could we say no?
It was stunning.
Yeah, so she's completely brilliant, such a joy.
And there are these two younger artists that have come to us that we're thrilled to, I guess, be sort of giving
the
opportunity.
And the Clara
and Fabrizio. And Clara is played by a wonderful young Melbourne singer named Genevieve Kingsford, mm-hmm. who in this sort of world of perfect synchronicity has also just been honoured. She's become announced as one of the 6 finalists of the Rob Guest Endowment Award, which happens yearly. It's a huge scholarship for young musical theatre performers. And Genevieve's made it to the top 6. Mm. And there's a huge concert and a final sort of judging of that after we close, sadly. Mm-hmm. But we're thrilled for her. We're very lucky to have her as part of our cast. And her partner in crime in this is the young Fabrizio, who is played by a gentleman named Jonathan Hickey, who's coming all the way from Brisbane to do this with us. And Jonathan's an incredible artist who's done a lot of work.
And he's a concert violinist.
Is he really?
Yes. And how old are they, Luke?
They're 23 years of age.
So overachievers.
Oh, my Lord. They're so talented. I mean, Genevieve trained in London, just recently got back to Melbourne. Jonathan's based in Brisbane.
And don't forget her degree in behavioural neuroscience
as well. That's true.
Doesn't everyone have one of those?
Well, yeah.
So
keeps
nice
these things in her pocket.
Because everyone's complaining about the younger generation, but there are some overachievers with them as well.
Oh, my Lord, yes. Yeah. And alongside these incredible gems, I mean, those three are beautiful, and we're so lucky. But we've got the likes of Josh Pitterman and
love him.
Anton
the
Berezin.
Wonderful Anton Berezin. We've got the incredible Jeremy Stanford, who is known as an amazing actor on stage and screen in Australia, made a name for himself in musicals by playing Tick in the original cast of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, the musical. So that was the Hugo Weaving role from the movie. So Jeremy's with us. We have, who else is in there?
Madison
the
Green.
Madison Green. We have
Johanna Allen.
Oh, Johanna Allen playing Signora Naccarelli.
All with CVs that, you know.
Wow.
Josh Pitterman, of course. Josh, who's incredible.
How many in the cast?
11.
11. Okay. Wow.
Now, it is a romance, and, you know, you could argue that every connection in a show is important, but I feel like romance might be up there as one of the hardest ones to get that connection right between the actors. So how did you make that happen? You know, how does that get pulled together and make sure those connections are strong?
With great delicacy from a director's point of view, you know, you need to let people make friends before you ask them to kiss.
That's always a good start, yeah.
But also they have a great deal of respect for each other, I think. You know, they can acknowledge each other's talent and their thrilled to be up there. And, I think what's really interesting about this story is that because of there's a secret about Clara, which is revealed in the story, and because of that secret, Margaret actually finds herself at the centre of the love affair, which is quite an interesting take. It's a different sort of triangle than we're used to seeing.
Now, a little bird told me, and he's sitting opposite me with glasses, that, Teresa, you did a hell of a lot of research for this musical, and the fact that all the cast said to you, well, how do we get into this feeling? You're like, how? And you've got all the answers because the research you've done for this has been astounding, I've heard.
Well, that's very sweet of Luke to say so.
But, true.
You know, we're working fast. You know, we're a very small company. We're an independent company, and there's only a limited amount of resources we can devote. So my job is to be as absolutely prepared as possible and inspire everybody with the confidence that I have a template for us. Mm. And then they can just use that as their trampoline to excellence. Yeah.
Now, I've actually seen some your ads on social media, and you're even doing a dinner and show, which is great, in an Italian restaurant. Yes. Is that right?
Yeah, Fatto, beautiful Italian restaurant at Art Centre Melbourne. It's on the side of the concert hall. They jumped on board. They were so thrilled to be able to offer this to their own, I guess, you know, regulars and people that love Fatto as an establishment. But we've put it out there, and the response has actually been incredible.
I mean, it's the perfect show, really, for Melbourne. You know, we love love Italy, don't we?
Yep.
The Festa's on this weekend, and there's such an incredible connection between Melbourne and Italy, and I really feel like it's the right show in the right place at the right time.
Totally.
Okay, so it opens this Friday.
Friday night at the Arts Centre.
Friday night at the Arts Centre. And it runs till November 6th.
Yeah, it's two weekends. So it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday over two weekends, which is wonderful.
Yep. And your old Brendan?
Well, yes, go see that show. But before I leave...
But you're not going. Ha, ha.
I know. I'm going to be in Italy myself.
He's winging his way back to my...
So not Florence, unfortunately, this time, but I will be in Milano.
Oh,
so,
beautiful.
You know, it'll do. But obviously go see this show. But I wanted to put you on the spot about City of Angels as well. Can we expect another production anytime soon? Because I was saying a little bit off air that I just adored. I thought it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And this is coming from a noir fan. So
Thank you, Brendan.
The base level was like very high, expectations.
We appreciate that. And we had a wonderful time producing that one last year. I think it's that thing where we have the opportunity to do these shows, as Teresa said, in such a short sort of period of time, and the development time is often very long, but then when we have to sort of rehearse and get it up and get it on, we only have a small window. And we've had the most incredible cast in last year's as well as this year's. Yeah. In fact, every year we've had an amazing cast, and all these people are being snapped up by other shows. I think half the cast of City of Angels are now either working on Aladdin or on Singing in the Rain or on various other shows that have opened around the country and the world. So we only get this window, and we want to make the best theatre that we can, get it on stage for that season, make sure that people see it, and hopefully they will come to Light the Theatre. And that's kind of it. It has a lifespan of...
At the minute, it's sort of see it before it passes into music theatre legend. Mm.
That's right.
So that's good advice.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Now, make sure you do check it out from this Friday until the 6th of November at the Art Centre. The Light in the Piazza is the name of the show. Make sure you check it out.
You're on Joy 94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy. Thanks for tuning in to Sunday Arts Magazine. It's Joy 94.9, the gayest station in the nation. Brendan Bale with you and David Hunt sitting opposite me and the wonderful Neil doing an amazing job on the panelling today. And now we've got a message in from Caroline and Trish. Hi, lads. Loving the interviews and, of course, great to hear the lovely Luke. We miss him, which is very true. Now, Caroline and Trish want to know, how many boots out of 10 do we give Kinky Boots, David? I'm going to put you on the spot.
I'm going to give it 8.
Okay. I would be probably even more generous and say
you always
I am. But 8.5. Nearly a 9. Half a boot. Half. 8 boots and a heel. Yeah. That goes out to Carolyn Trish. Thank you very much for the message. We've got our AGM today, which is amazing.
Well, it's finished now.
Well, it's done.
We've talked too much.
We've talked through it. but we're going to get straight into our next interview.
We're
going to squeeze it in. We're going to get all the juice out of this wonderful interview. Mark, playwriter and director of Anti-Hamlet.
Yes, that's the name of it.
I love it. We talk a fair bit about Mr. Shakespeare on
Is it a throwback to, is it anti-Shakespeare's Hamlet?
Well, it's kind of like, it's anti-Shakespeare's Hamlet as much as one can be anti-Shakespeare's Hamlet. When I wrote it, I tried desperately to not be Hamlet. And yet Hamlet is such a big, extraordinary thing which we've all inherited that it can't help but kind of squeeze through the cracks. Yep. So even though I've written something which is quite far away from Hamlet, it's actually very Hamlet at the same time.
Fantastic. I love it. But we always like to start off with finding out who you are. So, because you wrote this piece.
Yes.
And you're directing it. Mm-hmm. So where did all that start from?
Well, as a kid, I guess my parents diagnosed me with the theatre bug. And, so I was sent to drama classes.
Terrible.
And then I ended up studying that at, university. And then I went to drama school and a couple of other places, exciting places around the world to study theatre. And then here I am. I guess I've been a big Shakespeare fan for a very long time, and I was very lucky to become an international fellow of Shakespeare's Globe, which means you go to the beautiful rebuilt Globe Theatre in London, and you spend 6 weeks, 6 days a week from, I think it was 8 until sometimes close to midnight.
Wow.
With their head of voice, head of verse, head of movement, head of direction at the theatre, and you learn about how Shakespeare put on Shakespeare's plays back in the 16th century.
Fantastic.
How did that come about for you, though? Did you apply, or did someone seek you out?
And one of my teachers, Jenny Lovell, here in Melbourne, had done it a few years before, and I was cocky enough to say, hey, would you support my application? And she said, yes, but you're not going to get in. Oh, she wrote me an amazing letter of recommendation, and then I got in.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Good on you.
Yeah.
Now, what is it about Shakespeare? You know, because we ask so many guests because it's often about Shakespeare. What is it about him that you love?
I love Shakespeare's language, and I love his images and his ideas. And his ideas and the ambition of his ideas is what's really exciting for me.
And how they're timeless, aren't they? You know, which he wouldn't have been aware of that when he was writing them. Or do you think maybe he was?
I think he was talking, you know, it's that thing about be universal by being very specific. And he was so invested in and situated within his own world. And his world was Elizabethan England, where there's kind of the archetypal things that we're all still interested in: sex, power, violence, money, identity. All of that was in this great big melting pot of Elizabethan England. Mm. And of course, Elizabethan England was at the beginning of kind of British colonialism and kind of globalization in some ways was beginning during that period.
And they would have been thinking, we're the king of the castles, or people,
exactly,
we can achieve this, you know, like,
totally.
And with their writing. And also I think his subject matter, using famous people in history up until that time,
mm-hmm,
you know, even back to Cleopatra,
totally,
you know, and all the famous kings that and the madness of a lot of it. So it's incredible what he worked around.
Totally. And actually, he's defined a number of these historical figures,
yeah,
in the cultural imagination.
Yeah.
But what I think is especially interesting about Shakespeare is that Shakespeare kind of stops when Shakespeare dies. And so we don't actually have Shakespeare's insights on the specifics of everything that came after. We have a lot of things that we can read into. But for instance, we don't have a post-colonial thought in Shakespeare, of course, obviously. We don't have any thinking about Australia, for instance, to be very blunt about
it. How funny
it
would that be?
Yeah, I know, huh? So that's kind of where I come in.
So, but before we get into what you're doing, I've also got to ask you, you know, like how there's all the conspiracy theories about the fact that there wasn't just one person.
Mm.
What's your thought on that? You know, do you think there was just one Shakespeare, or was it a group of people?
Well, Even the most conservative of pro-Shakespeare scholars acknowledges that some of the plays are written collaboratively. Like, it's obvious, it's...
And that's fair enough.
Yeah. But I'm certainly not someone who thinks, oh, it was Lord so-and-so, or... I think it was a theatre writer who didn't go to university, who read a lot of classics in their extraordinary Elizabethan secondary school syllabus, and who had an extraordinary imagination and an extraordinary group of collaborators.
So tell us, why are you turning it on your head, which a lot of people do with Shakespeare, but you're rewriting it here, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's because of that thing that I was talking about what Shakespeare doesn't talk about. And always when I, because this is the third Shakespeare play that I've adapted, first was Macbeth and then Richard II. And each of these times I've tried to design a production as a director of the original play. And I haven't been able to, because I've got really excited about the content in the play, but then there's been something missing at the heart of it. And that has always been Australia itself, and also kind of an explicit queer identity. And so both of these things is what I've kind of shoved into Hamlet, kind of put it in, wrapped it in foil, put it in the microwave and let it explode.
Wow, I've never heard of anything like that before.
But it's kind of taking the implicit and making it explicit,
yes.
But then in a local context as well.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about those contexts then, the queerness and the Australian nature of it then.
Sure. So I guess... as a writer, I can't help but be autobiographical, and certainly my adaptation of Macbeth was very kind of autobiographical.
By the way, my favourite Shakespeare, Macbeth.
It's pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you should have seen it as a one-man drag show.
I'm pissed off I didn't see it.
So I guess into this, I made Hamlet a queer 30-year-old guy, and of course, Hamlet is a thinker as well as a doer and a lover. And so I was really interested in what are the consequences to what he thinks about if he was queer. Because, of course, for me, like, there's sex, of course, but I think what's most kind of radical about queer is the consequences in relation to society, in relation to how we structure the world and the way that power structures work. And, like, that's very Foucault and kind of 80s, 90s queer theory.
Huge fan of that by myself.
Yeah, it's very good. So if you have a prince of Denmark who is queer, instantly you have someone who is thinking about whether or not they fit into the existing paradigm that they've been born into. So then Hamlet is instantly thinking about inheritance. Does he deserve to inherit? What happens at the end of his reign if he becomes king? Who inherits from him? All of these kinds of things, which are there in the Shakespeare's original, but which I've kind of given a good twist of the lemon.
Yeah, I like it, knowing the play, and the fact that I can see how you can twist that. Yes.
Yeah. And then we kind of plonk that in an Australian context. And, oh, actually, we do have a monarchy. Oh, my God. As much as we kind of forget about them every now and then, they're still on our coins. They're still very much... our head of state is a woman named Elizabeth who lives in England. And her children and grandchildren will be our head of state unless we change something.
Which I don't think was going to happen.
Well, we're not very good at changing it, are we?
No.
So there's kind of the layer of our kind of lazy monarchism as a country, which is in there, and the kind of the tension between our democracy and our desire for independence, or our desire to be a nation which stands on its own two feet, well, slapped up against this kind of vassal state thing that we still have going after, 200 years after invasion, you know.
Yeah. How many people are in it? It's not a one-man show this time.
No, it isn't. There are 7 people. I'm in it, and then there are 6 others.
Now, you play the crazy man.
I play Hamlet himself, yes, yes. And this is the third time I've done this silly thing.
Because the publicity shot, when I went out to greet you, I thought, I know who you are in the show.
Yes. So it's I'm playing Hamlet, and then I'm surrounded by an extraordinary cast, and it's quite a big cast in an independent theatre show. So the extraordinary Natasha Herbert is playing my mother, and Brian Lipson, who many people will recognise from various shows, is playing Sigmund Freud, who is Hamlet's psychoanalyst, because, of course, Hamlet needs therapy.
Brilliant.
And who else but Sigmund Freud?
Brilliant. I love your mind. I love where it's going. That's great. So while writing this, you must have had so much fun.
Oh, yes.
And going for those walks where you you clear your head, and some of the things you would have come back with, you know, like, things like that happen for you?
Totally.
Yeah.
Normally, I start going for a walk thinking, oh, I'm never going to be able to finish this play. And then halfway through the walk, I take out my phone and suddenly I'm writing new scenes.
Exciting when you do
that? Oh, it's thrilling. Yeah. And also working with this extraordinary cast in rehearsals, you know, it's rewrites, it's new jokes, it's new insights into what's happening. And so we've got a very fun and creative rehearsal room as well.
How do you sort of balance the absurd with, you know, grounding the piece as well? Like, how do you get that ratio right?
Well, that's the big question. And I guess one of the actors, Marco, talked to me the other day about how kind of the bedrock of the play is what we began with. And we've kind of been pruning the hedges that are growing out of it. And in some ways, the gags and the absurd humour is kind of on top. But what's fundamental and what's serious is the soil of the show. And really, it's about investing in that and making sure that the ideas that we're playing with have real integrity and are really thought through.
Because that gives the audience an in, you know, especially, you know, if they have seen the original or read the original, I should say.
Yeah.
You know, it would give the audience an in, okay, well, this is what we can expect, but then it goes off track.
Totally.
Or
totally.
On its own track.
And comedy's a really great way to kind of play with theme in a very fun and accessible way. So that the plot is going along and that has lots of serious stuff in it. But the audience is really let in because of this absurdity and this playfulness.
Mm.
So it's called Anti-Hamlet. Love the title. It's immediately you know where it's going. It's playing down at Theatre Works in St Kilda on Ackland Street. Actually, we had Linden Gallery in well. So, you know, like you're
down the street
from each other. And it starts on the 3rd of November.
Sure does.
And goes to the 13th.
Come early, come often.
Yeah. We often have different shows that are playing there. Great space.
Beautiful space.
And you can adapt it for whatever you want to do, which I'm sure you have in this
case. Yes, this is a big show and we've got a big show for you.
Yeah, excellent. Mm. So thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see it. It sounds so much fun. it's through Theatre Works Bookings and it's Anti-Hamlet. Thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you. Cheers.
You're on Joy 94.9. Thank you very much to Mark Wilson, writer, playwright, actor and director of Anti-Hamlet. On Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for tuning in to Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9. It is nearly time to say goodbye.
Yes, and what a fantastic show, as they always are. And thank you for listening, because if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here.
We
hope you enjoy all the different, real eclectic group of people that we have in every week.
Exactly. And speaking of eclectic characters, we're going to leave you with a track.
Yes,
like that
from
Kinky Boots. Mm-hmm. And this is the introduction to Lola and her angels.
Mm.
It's a beautiful track. So I think if this is probably the standout track, I would say.
For you?
One of the standout tracks anyway.
Okay.
Top three. So we're going to leave you with this little present on Joy 94.9. This is Land of Lola.
And you have a wonderful holiday and we'll see you in a few weeks' time.
Thank you, David. And thanks to everyone out there. I'm going to miss you for the next 3 weeks, but I'll be back.
No, you won't.
Oh, I will. Enjoy this one on Sunday Arts Magazine. See you in a little while.
Leave expectations at the door. Just let your eyes explore.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.